It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
We're going to be looking at essentially what's been going on. We're now over a week into this thing, a week into the rebellion. We're going to be speaking about essentially what is on the table in terms of what Trump is proposing with invoking the Insurrection Act, who is pushing back against him within the state. You know, what are the factions that we're seeing within the ruling class, the fault lines, and also how does this play into Trump's game plan going into the election? Because if you can't tell right now, they are panicking. I mean, Trump is hemorrhaging support. It's not going very well. You know, if you haven't seen on the It's Going Down Twitter, there was a poll that was recently released where, you know, currently more people are sympathetic to burning down a police station in Minneapolis than they are in voting for President Trump in 2020.
Yep.
And, you know, Biden has a solid lead ahead of him in many states, and he continues to plummet in terms of support. It seems that the photo op that he did at the church, that was on, a few days ago, that was really a turning point in a lot of ways.
Yes.
And he's getting a ton of blowback from that. You know, generals are coming out. The people at the Pentagon are saying that they're not happy. There's a lot of editorials that are being written calling for Trump to be removed. This seems to be a really big turning point. And at the same time, the resistance in the streets is not going anywhere. We all know that we're seeing a huge wave of misinformation from the right and also from a lot of liberals and people on the left. There's just a ton of conspiracy theories out there. There's a lot of stuff on social media. But at the same time, the resistance in the streets is not going away. People continue to come out. There are demonstrations that are being called all the time. There's stuff happening all over the place in small towns, in big cities. It's happening all over, and people are not leaving the streets, and it would seem that the more the state kind of pushes back at people and represses people, the more people are coming out and saying that we're not going anywhere. And this is unlike anything that I've ever seen. This is unlike anything that people have seen at all. I mean, this does not compare, I would say, to the response after Ferguson. This is much, much different, and it's magnified on a huge scale. And I think that also the response from the people within the ruling class, they know at this point that they're going to have to offer some major concessions. Like just today, it was announced that the other three police officers that were there at the scene when George Floyd was murdered, they will also be charged with accessories to murder. And the main police officer, he will be moved up to second degree murder from third degree murder. So, I mean, they are definitely trying to pull out the stops and try to acquiesce to people's rage, and it doesn't seem to be working at all. But I think that they're realizing now. I mean, like, I just saw something on Twitter, you know, George Bush saying that we need to, like, re-examine, you know, the historical failures of the American Project and stuff like that. I mean, this would be unthinkable, like, in a different context. I mean, you know, before a president, somebody like George Bush would never say something like that. Now it's becoming impossible for people to continue forward without admitting that there are massive inequalities, massive contradictions within the system, and now they're trying to basically, you know, build back that broken social contract that's just been, you know, broken and smashed to pieces on the floor. And yeah. The question is are they going to be able to do that, or is something else going to emerge out of the ruins? So let's just kind of get started and let's talk about, you know, what's happening on the streets. Like, what is the big takeaway that we're seeing?
Yeah, so what's happening is there are demonstrations and riots breaking out everywhere. I mean, like, and everywhere is not an understatement. I mean, we're talking any medium to large city, a lot of suburbs outside those cities, like small towns, college towns, everywhere, which is something that we've never really seen at this scale. I mean, the anti-war movement had presence all over the place, right? The labor movement had presence all over the place, but the generalized conflict, political conflict, is totally new. And especially because it sustained itself at this point more than a week. There was generalized conflict around Rodney King in 92, but that burned itself out in a few days, right? This is sustained resistance, and something very fundamental has changed. What happened over the last week is that people decided that we had asked for reform, right? Like, after Ferguson, people went out into the streets and generally, by and large, asked for reform. And they decided not to get rowdy and not to riot and not to burn down police stations so they could get their reforms. And all of these liberal mayors all over the country said, yeah, we'll give you reforms. We'll give you reforms. We'll give you reforms. And then nothing changed anything. And then people went out again around George Floyd to protest, and they got tear gassed. And what happens in this process is that a lot of people are learning two lessons. The first is that police reform should never be the goal. That what we're looking at right now is we are looking at America coming to terms with its own history, with 400 years of racial oppression, with a governmental system grounded in slavery and genocide, with those elements of racial segregation in the United States infecting everything that happens here. And a lot of people are coming out now and they're saying, okay, so we're like at the beginning in Minneapolis, it's like, we're going to protest this thing. They got tear gas. So then everyone learned the second lesson, which is that protesting doesn't work. That direct resistance is the only way to get what you want. It's the only way to take control of the situation again. And so people, instead of running off the streets when they got gassed, fought back. And that is a fundamental sea change in American politics, because what it indicates is something very similar to a phenomena that occurred in Egypt in the Tahrir Square uprising, or it's also something very similar to what's been described in Hong Kong or been described in Lebanon, in Beirut, where people are, you know, rioting for, I think it's going on 3 months now. At the beginning of all of these sort of historical events, people hit the street tentatively and they're afraid of the police and they're afraid of the state. But then they win their first victory in the streets. They fight back and they run the police off the streets. And then all of a sudden the fear goes away. It's not that it disappears. It's that it becomes secondary to the goal. And what's happening in America right now is a lot of people have decided that the only way that we're going to get anything, the only way that we're going to change anything, is by forcing that change to happen on our own. And what that means is that the politicians have become delegitimized, the courts have become delegitimized as a mechanism of protection, and the police have become delegitimized. And that now has taken what was protests and turned it into an actual material conflict. So the separation here is that what happened around Mike Brown and later around people like Tamir Rice, right? I mean, this all kickstarted with Trayvon Martin. Those demonstrations were protests largely. They were turned into riots periodically. But at the end of the day, they were about expressing anger and trying to dialogue with the state, trying to ask the state for reform. This is no longer about talking to the state. This is about changing things on our own. And if that means that people have to run the police off the streets, and that means people have to run the police off the streets, and a lot of people are willing to do that right now, that what I've been seeing is that a fundamental shift has happened in America in the last week, where all of a sudden there is no more time to wait for a lot of people in their minds. There's no more time to wait to deal with the legacy of race in America, that we can't wait any longer. That we can't wait any longer to deal with police brutality. We can't wait any longer to deal with the violence of the state. We can't. And that's what people are doing. They're just dealing with it, right? And they're fighting back hard. This means that what we're witnessing is a shift from activism to actual fighting, right now in the form of an uprising. But very clearly, as time goes on and the state loses more and more control, it is very possible that whole areas of this country, neighborhoods and major cities, are already doing this in places like Minneapolis, where they've run the police out and have just decided to do safety differently. It's very likely we're going to see a lot more of that, where there are just going to be areas of the United States where the police just don't have sovereignty. They don't have control. That at that point is an insurrection, right? And we are literally watching right now events that are very similar to what happened in the mid to late 80s in the Soviet Union, where people had decided that the only thing left was just destroy the regime. And we're watching that narrative shift happen in the part of this week. Even journalists are starting to say, after the photo op Trump did in front of the church in Lafayette Park, even journalists are starting to talk about, okay, this was about police brutality. This definitely still needs to stay focused on the history of racism in America, but right now the focus needs to be on regime change. And that's a huge thing. That's a massive difference. Journalists in major publications are walking right up to the line of asking people to go overthrow the regime.
I would say it's interesting too, because not only it came off of the tail of the Ahmaud Arbery thing, where that video came out and automatically, what did they do? They went and arrested the people finally because they were scared of a riot. And then when this happened, what did they do? They fired the police right away because they knew that something big was coming, or they could feel it. And they said, you know, if we don't do something right now, something might pop off. So they fired those people, but it still didn't matter. And then I think almost instinctively, people knew that they had some momentum. And then all of a sudden the riots started to happen. And, you know, it grew and grew and it grew into a rebellion. And now it's spread across the country. And now as we're seeing, it's spreading across the world. I mean, Paris is up in flames. Greece, people London. Attacked the American Assembly. There's people all over the world that are taking to the streets over this thing. This is a huge global moment, not just in the United States. I think a lot of people don't actually realize that are maybe listening to this, that there are people, thousands of people across the world that are taking to the streets and fighting back because of what's happening in the United States. They're seeing what's going on and they're inspired by it. Yeah. And I think, again, and we'll probably come back to this, if people can get beyond this idea that somehow that, quote, the rioters and the looters are somehow magically disconnected from what's going on, or that there's bad people over here and good people over here. It's like, no, the state views all of us that are in the streets as the problem. I mean, you think in the grand scope of things, when you pull out that the state actually cares that three Rolex stores got stolen from, you think they actually give about that? No, they care about tens of thousands of people taking to the streets to find the military and the police. That's what they care about. They could care less about a target.
And so how do they define bad? And I think that this is the important part. They define bad as people who are willing to directly resist, right? It's not that they define bad based on property destruction, or that they define bad based on militancy. They define bad based on people who are willing to fight back when the police attack, right? Now, there's a reason behind this. And I think that right now, people are stuck in this conversation about arguing about good and bad. We need to get totally past that. Those categories don't matter here. Why is the state presenting the good protester, bad protester model? And the reason is actually very simple. If we go back into the corpus of literature around counterinsurgency, and we're talking early stuff or historical texts like Learning to Eat Soup with a Knife, things like that, the kind of foundational texts of counterinsurgency theory, right? Or we look at the U.S. Counterinsurgency Manual as written by David Petraeus, which every single soldier in the U.S. military was trained in 15 years ago And a lot of those soldiers are now cops, right? If we look at what that body of literature says, it's very clear that to do counterinsurgency effectively, what you need to do is, as they put it, you need to separate the population from the combatants. Okay. And the way that they talk about this is they say, okay, the population are people who might also have grievances and might protest, but won't fight you. And the insurgents are people that are going to directly resist. And so the goal of counterinsurgency is to take the people that are angry, that might join the insurgency, give them a bunch of concessions, treat them as if they're good, support them in stuff, so then they will then turn on the remaining insurgents, which then justifies the repression of the insurgents, right? So what they're doing is they're creating the conditions that allow for a repressive strategy to be utilized by building the legitimacy of that strategy by labeling certain actions the actions of bad people, separate from everybody else. And so every single person out there who is propelling this narrative of good protesters and bad protesters or riot shaming people for being involved in direct resistance, you are contributing to counterinsurgency every single time. And please, people who listen to this, feel free to straight call people out on that, right? They are literally a part of the counterinsurgency strategy, whether they think they are or not at that point. And that makes them collaborators, right? We have entered a situation of an uprising. We are in a material conflict with the state in a very acute way at this point. And so people that are collaborating actually are a danger to the health and safety of the people that are out in the streets. And so every single time someone decides to riot shame somebody else or sit there and try and complain about people looting, the only way that we need to respond is to send them a link to the counterinsurgency manual and say, you are a part of this. Retract what you're saying or we want nothing to do with you. Every single person that's willing to riot shame right now needs to be fundamentally, completely 100% cut out of organizing, period, around this, period. They can't be trusted. They are now a part of the state repression strategy, whether they want to be or not. But they're being leveraged in that way.
Yeah, I mean, the strategy is very clear, is to basically make it appear that if you're good, you're essentially being non-disruptive. I mean, really, that's that is the message. And that if you are good, you will cut yourself off and not associate with the bad people. Mm-hmm. I mean, the problem is that, I mean, people hear that and then their experience though is that they were walking down the street and the police beat them and shot them with tear gas and everything. And they come to realize that really that narrative is false and really that. Yes. You, by being on the street, by engaging in this, you have made yourself an enemy of the state just by de facto living and asserting your own autonomy in the face of police and military that are basically saying, get off the street because we're trying to regain control of the entire country because people are simply refusing to go home. I mean, it's a very simple, you know, calculus, but I mean, I think people really need to understand that. And yeah, again, you know, just not let ourselves get divided by these petty things. I mean, it's strange that we allow people in power to really set the tone of the dialogue. I mean, they get to come out with these things. I mean, you know, like even it's so silly when you think about it, even talking about Antifa. I mean, literally, you know, people that are organizing around anti-fascism.
Yeah.
You know, like there hasn't even, you know, what's so funny, there hasn't even been a large scale anti-fascist mobilization since the thing in Portland in late August of 2019, almost a year ago.
Right.
And this is the only trope that they have. The only trope that they have is basically a stupid meme that trolls will have to bring out so they can shake the can and get people to give the money on their Patreon from a year ago. That's all they have. Because really, the alternative is to say, look, America, your kids are in the streets and there's a Zoomer insurrection. We want to send the military in and shoot them all because they're not going to say that. And they, they cannot say that we want to basically decimate an entire generation of especially black and brown youth. But what they can say is that we're going after, quote, the looters, the thugs. Gee, I wonder what that means. Right. And the Antifa and the anarchists. And I think what they're seeing, though, is that even that narrative isn't working, because you're looking at a lot of the Democrats and they're changing their tone and they're making it about Mexican drug cartels, or they're making it about Boogaloo Boys, which have come out like what, like maybe five of them on the periphery.
There is a single instance of Boogaloo Boys being arrested for something, which was in Las Vegas, and they weren't even at the site of a protest.
Right, exactly. Yep. I mean, which is not to say that there isn't a problem of far-right violence, which there is, but that's literally coming from basically random Trump supporters or far-right people that are going to demonstrations trying to drive, you know, run them over or shoot them, and that has happened.
And what's important is they're targeting protesters. They're not escalating the riots, which is what the conspiracy theory is.
And I think that, again, that's – if there's one kind of conspiratorial part of the left that just – continues to beat with intensity, it's this idea that somehow, quote, the state wants us to do this, and mm-hmm. that therefore they are basically pushing some like sort of, you know, they want us to burn down a store, they want us to loot, they want us to fight the police, because then they can justify repression. I mean, they're going to try to justify whatever they can no matter what happens.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? You know, they will try to this is exactly what we're seeing. They will try to create the narrative so they can justify what they're doing. But they don't want the country to get out of control. That's a complete fallacy.
Yes. Well, and if we – and again, like I've studied – police tactics and military theory and things like this for years, right? And the entire body of literature, without exception, around crowd control and kinetic situations in insurgencies, says that the goal should be to de-escalate kinetic conflict. Because at the end of the day, I mean, the reason for this is very logical. In any given city, there's only so many police, right? For them to impose their will into our lives requires them to be able to move around space, to be able to respond to things, to engage in repression. At the point where there is an acute conflict in the streets, they can't do that. They fundamentally fail to function as a police force with any kind of reach at the point where riots break out. They're not able to contain the situation. They're not able to de-escalate the situation. They're not able to maintain control of the situation. They're not even able to make sense of the situation. And in military theory, or in large logistical structures like a police force, if you can't make sense of what you're seeing, you can't respond to it, period. There's no way to organize the response of people and equipment to a spot if you can't even make sense of what's happening. And so considering that police are always outnumbered in these situations in the last week, right? That's not always the case in the past, but in the last week, what they've done is they've started retreating back to protect core assets, police stations, commercial districts, things like that. But the idea that they would escalate the scenario intentionally through sending agent provocateurs into a demonstration is literally never happened in contemporary American history since the 1970s, and completely flies in the face of the totality of all of the literature around crowd control, literally every single piece of literature. There's not a single piece of crowd control literature that encourages escalation. Every single piece of contemporary crowd control literature encourages containment and making sense of situations, surveillance, and intelligence gathering. Containing the scenario and being able to allow it to burn itself out and disperse on its own, because that's the only way that they can maintain control, right? And again, there's so many conspiracy theories about agent provocateurs from the police going in and breaking stuff, right? There's literally no evidence for any of it. Like, literally none. No one's been able to show a shred of verifiable evidence for any of it, which makes sense considering that it would be a counterproductive strategy for them. Right. We all saw in Minneapolis, and we're seeing in places like New York, what happens when the cops can't contain the situation. They lose. They get run off the streets. Right. Like, literally.
Yeah. I've been thinking a lot about this point that a lot of people have made over the years about Hitler and the way that he argued. You know, he would say things like, well, what are we going to do about this Jewish problem?
Mm-hmm.
And then if you would respond and be like, you know, well this is, then all of a sudden you agree that there is a Jewish problem.
Yep.
And then all of a sudden that they've basically set the terrain in the terms of the debate, and suddenly you're talking about Jews running the world and what you're going to do about them. And all of a sudden you've basically entered into basically, you know, their politics and what they want to do.
Yes.
And I think basically, you know, they're doing the exact same thing. You know, what are we going to do about this Antifa problem? It's like, we have an Antifa problem. First of all, being an anti-fascist is a bad thing.
Right.
You know, literally there are FBI agents asking people that have been arrested, these protests now, taking them aside after their court dates, being like, are you sympathetic to anti-fascism? As if that's a bad thing. I mean, it's incredible, but I mean, this is the world that we're living in. But again, we can't allow the government and the media to set the terrain of this debate. I mean, this thing kicked off because people were angry about something and they imposed themselves into what's happening, not that we allowed them to basically set the tone. And as long as the state continues, it's going to try to do that. It's going to try to say, like, we've reasserted our authority. You know, the social contract is here. We have your best interest at heart. You know, like, one of the things that I keep hearing over and over again from police or governments is that, you know, we hear you. It's time for you to go home.
Yeah.
And it's such a paternalistic kind of relationship, because that's the one that the state is used to. It's used to basically a dumb, passive population, especially from essentially, you know, as Chomsky would say, you know, 80% of the population is just basically supposed to go to work, and they're not supposed to really think. You know, maybe they come out and vote every 4 years if they're really moved to, but basically their job is just to basically go to work and shut up.
Yeah.
You know, the idea is really supposed to be relegated to like this 20% of kind of this, you know, creative, cultural, political, upper middle class that's supposed to have ideas. Well, now the working class is starting to come out and poor people and assert itself. And, you know, it's like, no, we have an experience and this is basically how it's going to be. And we're going to set the tone. And there's a whole lot more of us than you.
With protests continuing in cities all over the world, the Channel Zero Network has some reminders on how to support those who have been arrested and those who may be arrested in the coming days and weeks.
Arrests are one tool cops use to repress mass movements. Arrests keep protesters off the streets during demonstrations. They scare people with the threat of court cases and potential prison sentences. Alone, we feel defenseless against the police and the courts. By providing jail and court support, we can push back against this repression, from the moment our comrades are taken in to the end of their court case.
Before heading out into the streets, make sure you and everyone you're with has a contact number written on their body. You'll need to get in touch with someone if you're arrested, and you most likely won't have your personal belongings with you. This number can be the National Lawyers Guild, a group you're currently involved with, or just a friend who's not at the protest.
If you see someone getting arrested, call your legal support number with the arrestee's legal name and birthday. If you're in a large city, you may have to determine where they will be taken. Try to find the arresting officer's precinct or unit. This may determine where your comrade ends up. In smaller cities, everyone may go to the same place.
If you expect more arrests, try to stay and observe. If not, you should head to the precinct and wait for the arrestee.
Once at the precinct, use the legal name and birthday of the arrestee to ask the cops for the arrest number, charges, and where the arrestee will be taken or held. Keep anyone supporting you in a loop.
Be prepared to wait many hours. Keep in touch with others and take turns waiting outside the precinct. In some cases, it may take the whole night, especially if there's been a mass arrest.
From here, each city and state has different processes and different jargon. Connect with local organizers and read about local laws to learn what the process will be in your area. Here are some things you might encounter.
Sometimes arrestees are released quickly with a notice that they'll need to show up in court at a later date. If this happens, take the contact info of the arrestee. You'll want to be ready to offer them court support in the future.
Sometimes, arrestees are charged before release. This is a longer process, usually called arraignment, which is a procedural court hearing to file charges and set bail. The court will assign a public defender for arraignments. Try to have a couple of friends attend the arraignment for support. Due to COVID-19, you may only be able to observe via video.
Sometimes arrestees will have to post bail to be released. If bail is set, let the court officer know you're arranging payment and will be coordinating with the arrestee's lawyer. If you need support making bail, connect with local organizers. There may be a bail fund for protesters in your area.
No matter what happens, always relay what's happening to other people offering support.
Regardless of the legal situation the arrestee ends up in, you'll need to bring some things with you. People who are getting out may be exhausted or have trouble getting home. So bring snacks, water, aspirin, bus fare, transit cards, and cigarettes. If you have a friend being held, you can bring their favorite snacks. If you know the arrestee requires specific medication, make sure to bring that too.
You'll also need water and snacks to sustain yourself. Bring external batteries for charging phones as you may be waiting many hours.
If you can't stay and help with jail support, dropping off materials to those waiting can be a big help.
Unfortunately, there is a high risk of exposure to COVID-19 while in an enclosed jail cell. Arrestees should consider self-quarantining and getting tested.
For every street action and every viral video of arrests, there are dozens of people outside the spotlight supporting the movement. It's not over till everyone's safely gotten out of prison and everyone's beaten their charges.
Check out Rebel Steps jail support episode at rebelsteps.com/jail support for more tips and resources.
And follow Unicorn Riot and Channel Zero Network member It's Going Down for more updates.
The Channel Zero Network sends y'all solidarity.
Stay safe out there and never stop fighting for a better world.
The Insurrection Act of 1807, right, was a law passed in the United States to formalize the process through which the U.S. military could be called in to put down a domestic uprising. This was an attempt to codify the process that George Washington went through in his administration, which is pre-constitutional, in order to put down the Whiskey Rebellion, right? And the way that they wrote the Insurrection Act was written around the idea that the president would just be a responsible person, that they wouldn't call the military in for their own personal gain, that it would only be to end dangerous situations that might lead to the overthrow of the government, blah, 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 blah. Right? Now, the Insurrection Act has been used dozens of times in American history, but it's been used significantly less since World War II. And part of the reason is that the calculus around legitimacy in the United States changed. That we went from a space in which the U.S. was a capitalist utopia where people could make their living, blah, 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 as the image was in the early 20th century, right? To a worldview in which the United States was pushing forward a politics of global liberty, right? And human rights, which was sort of the narrative that built up after the Second World War. And in concert with that narrative, the Insurrection Act has been invoked very infrequently since the end of World War II. The most recent instance in which the Insurrection Act was actually invoked, as opposed to just being talked about being invoked, was actually during 1992, during the Rodney King uprising, right? When George H.W. Bush ordered the military to go to Los Angeles. Now, that was only Los Angeles. The Insurrection Act was not declared anywhere else in the United States, even though there were other riots happening all over the U.S. So what is the Insurrection Act? The Insurrection Act essentially allows a U.S. president to declare an area under a state of insurrection and deploy the military. Now, in theory, there's no check and balance on that, right? But in practice, there's never been any governor or local mayor that's ever resisted the military coming into their area to put down an uprising. Now, what we're looking at now is fundamentally different. Because Trump is insisting on his right to do this. But the people that he's claiming he's trying to help put down the uprising don't want him to call in the military. Even the military doesn't want him to call in the military. Right? And so we're entering a really complex situation, possibly, in which it is theoretically possible that Trump could order the military to show up in a state and the governor could refuse. And that could set off a standoff between that state and the federal government. Very likely, if something like that were to happen, it would happen in New York, where Cuomo has already sued the federal government to block the deployment of troops. But Trump is insisting that they deploy troops in New York City, right? So what that would essentially mean, though, is that a state has gone to war with the federal government by refusing to allow the military to set foot on its territory. Right. That's a huge crisis that could also tip over the crisis in the military itself, where the commanders specifically former generals are now coming out against this. Mark Esper, the current Secretary of Defense, came out against invoking the Insurrection Act today. That the military itself has no interest right now in deploying troops in any significant way outside of Washington, D.C., where they already have thousands of troops, right? And so this could set off a scenario in which the military as a whole refuses orders. And if that happens, now we're looking at a situation in which there's a president sitting in the White House with no authority to impose whatever his dictates are. Because the military is now no longer under his control, which, again, would be unprecedented in American history. But even if we assume that the military goes along with this and they deploy troops to the streets, there's two other crises that that's going to set off. The first is a lot of these troops, like a lot of the soldiers in the U.S. Army, which will be what gets deployed likely, are from these same communities that are now currently like rising up. And they're not going to shoot their family members and their friends. Like, they're just not. And they're not going to shoot people they identify with. And so now we're looking at a situation in which there's mass disobeying of orders, potential defection from the military. We're also looking at a situation in which if they call the military in, all of a sudden there's no more space for there to be any discussion at all. And everything breaks down into a full-blown insurgency. And so the way that Jim Mattis and Mike Mullen put it in their op-eds that have come out in the last couple of days is if Trump deploys the military, that is the end of America, period. And they're not wrong about that. They're absolutely 100% fundamentally correct. It is unclear which way the American project will end, but there are at least four different scenarios in which the American project fundamentally ends because he orders the deployment of the military. Now, given that Mark Esper came out today and said that he is against invoking the Insurrection Act, it is probably unlikely that that is the route that Trump will take at this point, because for whatever's being said publicly, he is facing much more resistance behind the scenes to this. He might try and do this for propaganda purposes, like he did in D.C., where he deployed 200 military police to Washington, D.C. from Fort Bragg in North Carolina and claimed that was deploying the military into D.C. There are already thousands of military personnel in Washington, D.C. on any given day, just like going to work. So what Trump did was purely for propaganda purposes. It didn't actually fundamentally change anything on the ground, right? So we're looking at a situation now in which if he decides to act, it could end the American project and potentially lead to a significant political initiative to overthrow his administration, which a lot of journalists are starting to call for, right? If he doesn't act, he looks powerless and weak, sitting in his bunker, tweeting random stuff at people and threatening people over the internet, right? But that's pretty much all he's got. He is not capable mentally of handling this any other way. And so what that means is that one of two things is going to happen soon. Either governors and the military and the National Guard are going to start ignoring him, which seems to kind of be what's happening, or he's going to try and push forward, and there's going to be a massive, massive history-making political crisis in the United States.
When you say this could be the end of the American political project if he invokes the Insurrection Act, explain that. I mean, why is it that him doing that would be such a big deal, and why would it be, you know, a problem for the United States?
So we have to understand two things to make sense of that. The first is that America is not based on just a claim about the rights of people in America. And it's not based on like the Soviet Union, which was a revolutionary project, or so they said, which was meant to develop into something else, into some endpoint. America is a political project grounded in utopianism. And it's grounded in the idea that America is utopia, that this is the fundamental expression of all of the highest ideals of human existence. And every president says that during every single State of the Union address, if you listen carefully, right? That's one of these ideas that gets repeated so much in America. It's like not something people feel, but they say, sort of like freedom isn't free, right? It's just kind of like a slogan. But deep down in the American political ethos is this idea that America is a utopian project. And core to that idea is the notion that the military is a civilian military that is not to be used against its own citizens, period. Right? Now, of course, there have been situations where the U.S. military has been called out on American citizens, right? But those are considered to be extreme situations. And they're considered to be highly localized.
Or let's be real, people that are outside of whiteness. I mean, obviously the military was used against, you know, its greatest enemy, the native people across the so-called United States.
Absolutely. But one of the things that people now say is, okay, well, World War II happened and like we did desegregation. And so like we don't act that way anymore. Right. And that's kind of a common mantra in the United States because we've come closer to realizing the utopian vision of the American project. If the military gets deployed nationwide to suppress what is a popular uprising, mind you, right? This is not a minoritarian political initiative. This is a popular uprising with majority support right now, and like vast majority support. If they were to do that, most Americans would see that as the executive branch using the military to impose its political will on people, and that would be the end of the idea that the American Utopian Project functions. It would be over at that point. That what people would see is that though those ideals exist, they're ephemeral and that the state itself can always just ignore them. And this has been a discussion during the Trump administration so far already, that we had all these ideas of checks and balances. We had all these ideas of American political norms that we all had assumed functioned, right? Whether we like them or not, we assumed that the normativity of those limitations actually had some functionality. And then someone walks into office who doesn't know what those limits are and doesn't care, and all of them fall apart completely, right? The only thing that's holding up the idea of the legitimacy of the American project right now is that people still hold out hope that there is something left within the American political system that will prevent all of this tipping over into dictatorship. And at the point in which Trump deploys the military, a lot of people will see that as his attempt to seize power, right? In the same way that one would when one is trying to eliminate any sort of so-called democracy, right? That would end the project right there. Like, it would turn into full-blown civil unrest at that point.
Evangelical!
And let's be real. I mean, a lot of these people do not like Trump. I mean, they look at him as a bumbling buffoon because he is. And I mean, I think the other issue too is that they know that what he's doing is possibly sparking a revolution, not only within the United States, but possibly other places too.
Yes.
And they don't want that. I mean, they want they want nice, easy, smooth, running neoliberal society. I mean, that's what they want. And they don't want this bumbling idiot screaming about QAnon fantasies and, you know, retweeting neo-Nazis online, you know, getting everybody upset, you know, that does not bode well for management.
Yeah. So, I mean, Trump throwing gas on the fire is a really interesting phenomenon because generally presidents try and do exactly the opposite, right? They try and get everything calmed down. Being calm is good for capitalism, right? People can make projections about the returns from their investments and things like that. When the situation looks like this, no one can do that, right? And so the basic functioning of American political economy, like, relies on the scenario being predictable and calm, right? Generally, like, you know, I was talking to some friends about what would this look like under an Obama administration, right? Which on some level, it wouldn't look that different because, you know, people got tear gassed under the Obama administration too. But he wouldn't be threatening to call the military out and he'd be saying a bunch of like woke sounding stuff, right? Nothing actually would be that different at the end, but he would sound like he was going to do something different at least. And like in Obama's kind of political ethos, the goal is always de-escalate the situation, come to an agreement, right? Like this is always how he operated. Every other president in American history would be doing that. Well, any contemporary president in American history, maybe after Nixon, would be doing that, right? Even Reagan, when Reagan had to deal with civil unrest, it was all about, hey, okay, cool, you're going to get reforms, just everyone just go home now, please, right? This is really fascinating because on some level, Trump is walking right up to the line of creating the conditions that will end his own administration. And the reality is that he has no idea that that's what he's doing. None at all. He's sitting in a bunker under the White House, tweeting random stuff at people on the internet because he doesn't have any other idea of what to do. He's completely lost.
So the Democrats have positioned themselves as against this, but they're still flooding the streets with National Guard. So where do they stand in all this? Because I think the other big thing to point out, and this is definitely kind of in the big picture, is that, I mean, this is not only a revolt against the police, you know, as I see it, this is a revolt of, you know, what decades of, you know, largely Democratic, you know, rule looks like. This is the end result of decades of neoliberalism, of, you know, post-civil rights inability to deal with colonialism and white supremacy, but also, you know, the rule of Democrats and basically their failure to not only deal with the contradictions of, you know, the current society, but also, you know, exacerbate them.
So the Democrats are in a hard place right now. We're on one level, they can't be seen as being against what's going on, right? They rely on, to a large degree, votes from the black community to stay in power, right? And that includes young people in the black community, right? And they definitely rely on people of color in general to stay in power. Like that's their single largest voting block is people of color for the Democratic Party, right? And they win vast majorities amongst non-white people in the United States, right? Like by wide margins. So they have to be seen as being supportive. They have to be seen as saying, we hear you. But at the same time, they themselves can't be seen as encouraging direct action. Because if they were to encourage direct action, that would endanger their own power, right? So then they're stuck in this other kind of contradiction where on one level, it is their own constituents that are rioting in cities run largely by Democrats, right? But at the same time, they need votes of those same people. And so what they're trying to do is they're trying to cut this line where they're using the demonization of, quote, bad protesters and trying to say that they're, quote, outside agitators or anarchists, quote unquote, or whatever. In order to be able to differentiate enough to be able to say we support protests, we don't support rioting, right? Now, of course, all of that is part of the same counterinsurgency strategy. And I think that this is important to recognize. When Democrats say the right thing, but still call the National Guard out, when Democrats are sitting there riot shaming people and differentiating between, quote, good protesters and bad protesters, they are creating the conditions which put all of us in danger too. They are also contributing to the coming counterinsurgency campaign that is already starting and will very much continue as this goes on, right? And that makes them just as complicit with what's happening here, just as complicit with the repression as the Trump administration is. They don't want to be seen that way. And actually what we are seeing politically is that Trump is collapsing in the polls. Biden is shooting up in the polls and raising tons and tons of money, like hand over fist, millions of dollars really quick, while Trump's fundraising falls through the floor, right? And so on some level, their strategy has been somewhat effective, that they've been able to say, okay, cool, we're supportive. Give us money. We're supportive. We're going to do something to fix this. But at the same time, that's not quelling the resistance, right? It's getting them in a position to win the election, but it's not stopping people fighting back, right? And at the end of the day, a lot of people are going to hold these same Democratic mayors and governors responsible for what the National Guard does in these cities. So I know in the city I live in, for example, which is run by Democrats, the whole city is under a military occupation right now. People can't drive anywhere. There's curfews, everything. And that was after a single day of demonstrations that got rowdy. And so this is a lived reality for a lot of people. I think this election cycle coming up in 2020, the Democrats will get away with it because people want to get rid of Trump, because Trump has now become a threat to people's lives in a very direct way, right? It's no longer abstract. It's no longer like Trump is going to, you know, undo environmental regulations. We're all going to die from climate change, right? It's not abstract like that. It's very direct. It's Trump is going to call the military out and they're going to shoot me at a protest. And so for a lot of people,
voting. And it's been very direct for a lot of people for a long time. Let's be clear about that too.
Sure. But I think
Trump put my parents in a detention facility. Now they have COVID-19 and they got sick.
Yeah. But this is so him threatening to call the military out though was this moment in which even a lot of white liberals were like, yo, like maybe this is the time we have to like physically do something.
There's a great book. I'm actually looking at it right now. It's called The Wages of Whiteness. And, you know, it's based mm-hmm. on the W.B. Du Bois quote. Mm-hmm. But, you know, basically it argues that white supremacy gives, you know, the psychological and at times material wage to white people if they agree to basically go along with the system. I mean, obviously the police and the military are experiencing that, but at the point where you're at now, where basically the only way you're going to get that is if you're on the side of Trump, if you've listened to this show for the past, you know, years or so, you realize that we've been talking about the fallacies of, you know, his America First, basically bring globalization home, race to the bottom, wages, you know, oh, by the way, your job just got stolen by a robot at Walmart. And, you know, basically race war at the border, race war inside, you know, while the rich get richer and the rest of us get screwed. I mean, you know, where are these supposed benefits of this glorious, white race that he supposedly represents? I mean, I don't see it.
Right. Well, and so for a lot of people, I think, you know, we've been talking for months now about the reckoning that's coming inside of the Democratic Party, right? We talked about this all the way through the primary season, in which there's a fundamental shift going on inside of the Democratic Party right now. There's one going on in the Republican Party too, but there's a fundamental shift going on with the Democratic Party. I think one of the things that all of this means is that on some level, that fundamental change in the Democratic Party is going to stall solely because people are so desperate to get Trump out of office at this point that they're willing to back whoever the Democrats throw at them at this point. That does not mean, however, that the anger dissipates, right? And I think that this is something that some politicians are starting to realize, is that they can forestall change. They can throw roadblocks in the way. They can create committees. They can jam stuff up in like city council proceedings. They can do all of this stuff. They can write really obtuse language and laws to hide the fact that they're not actually doing police reform, blah, blah, blah. Like they can do that. And they did do that all over the United States, right? Anyone that lived in a city which had significant anti-police brutality demonstrations 4 or 5 years ago saw this exact same process go down, right? And there is going to be a cost to pay for that. Because it is that phenomena that led to this series of events. And the response of those same Democrats was to call the National Guard in a lot of these cities. And there is going to be a price to pay for that, too. It's probably not going to happen in November. But immediately after that, there's going to be a significant price to pay for the politicians that facilitated the situation and then used the military to try and repress it.
People give up, you know, the robust nature of the revolt if they go back to basically being a passive, you know, we're going to sit down and, you know, tell you how we feel. If it goes back to that, then basically all of this is for naught, and there will be a massive clampdown and people will get screwed all over.
Yep. Well, and we have to send the signal too, that we can't betray the people that have already been arrested and charged. That to get off the streets now is to betray every single person who is now facing felony charges for standing up. Every single one of them. It's to betray the memory of all the people that have been murdered by the police. It's to betray the memory of every single rebel that's come before us. Right? We cannot get off the streets until things fundamentally change and there's at least some sort of amnesty for the people that were arrested so far. Like, absolutely. And that is something that in Europe is a pretty common demand. That when protests start and people start getting arrested, that all of a sudden the protests continue and start demanding amnesty for the people that have been arrested. And we need to be doing the exact same thing here. That the only way that we are going to make it out of this situation with a better world than we went into it is if we all stick together, if we all stop all the fear mongering and the conspiracy mongering, if we stop demonizing and riot shaming people, and if we start standing up for the people that have already had to deal with repression in this situation and continue the fight until we get what we need. It's the only way out of this situation. That's it, right? There is no other way where we come out of this, okay, where we come out of this actually having made some sort of advance in the way that we live lives, that we come out of this with a realignment of how power works, right? If we are going to declare that we are going to engage in this struggle, as so many people have over the last couple of weeks, that also means that we have to take it to the end. That there's literally no excuse to back off now, right? And yeah, a lot of people feel like warm fuzzies seeing cops kneel down next to people and stuff, but it's all summarized very nicely by a meme I saw today, right? The meme is a picture of a grizzly bear in a river with a bunch of salmon. And the caption says, the grizzly bear kneels in the river with the salmon to show solidarity. Right? That is what we're dealing with. Our predators, the people who hunt us in the streets, who victimize our communities, who tear our communities apart by throwing people in prison, who brutalize us, who attack us every single day if you live in a working class community. Those people are now the same people that are trying to say that they're in solidarity with what we're doing. That is not something that we should in any way entertain until they start dropping their badges and changing sides, period. Right? And we have to stand very firm on that kind of an idea. There is no collaboration. There is no cooperation with the state. There is no cheering for cops that kneel. There is no patting the mayor on the back for showing up at the march. All of these people are responsible for what is going on right now. All of these people are responsible for putting us in a point in history in which we feel like we have to go risk our health and our safety to be able to get a world that's worth living in, right? And every single one of these people needs to be held to account for that. Now, right now, a lot of people, I think, are willing to fight and try and get Trump out of office in order to stop the military from coming in to shoot everybody. But once that process is over, once this administration is gone, there's going to be a lot of reckoning for a lot of people who are in positions of power, who facilitated and allowed this to happen. And we cannot be finished with this process until that happens. We can't. We literally can't. That to walk off the streets before then is to make this all for nothing. To make it so that hundreds of people will get prison sentences for what they did, and all of it will be worth nothing. Nothing. Right? We can't betray the people that have already paid the price for this resistance. We can't betray them. And to get off the streets would be doing exactly that.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.